Colonel Burke, reel 4.
But you were given bread and put the butter on yourself. Well, the butter never went far enough because to cover anything. But you then, if you wanted some more, you ate dry bread. Very, very occasionally we had some kind of cake, or not very often.
Did you find that the food was adequate for your appetites, or did you have to supplement it?
Oh, no, it was adequate, but it was so, you know, monotonous diet. You knew exactly what you were having every day.
What time did tea was the last meal of the day.
Yes.
Was that also the end of the working day?
Oh, yes, that was the end of the working day. Yes.
How did you pass the time aboard ship in the evenings?
Well, down in the hold, there was a games room where they had draughts and chess and 2 billiard tables. There were also dancing classes, which weren't well attended. You had to dance with another boy, you see. And the other thing was a library. A library was open. And you could draw a book out and you signed for it and you took it back when you finished and got another one. But otherwise, there was nothing to do.
Did you have shore leave regularly?
Wednesday afternoon and Saturday afternoon, where you went to play games. Now, you were taken aboard, you were taken ashore in cutters. Then by the big boys, you see, because they had to row in them. There were six or eight oars. And they were on duty, and they carried about probably 150, 180 boys ashore. Well, you didn't march up to a field which was about a mile up into Rock Ferry. You made your own way up, you know. You loitered up with the... provided you knew you were playing a game, you were there, you didn't keep the master who was going to referee at waiting, and you learnt football, and there was cricket, and there was running. We had sports in the summer, you know, running sports, tug of war and high jump, all the usual things. And then you come back again and have your tea when you came aboard.
You said that one of the other social activities aboard ship were the tea parties with the captain and wife. What were they like?
Oh, well, I don't know. It's like going to... you very rarely saw the captain's wife, and she was very affable. But you felt this eye of the captain on you, and you always remembered what a fool you'd made of yourself, and wondering whether he was... you know, remembering it. You didn't eat half which you could have, because they were, to what we had, it was lovely. Because you didn't want to appear a pig, you see. But they'd hand you round the first time, and they said, oh, do help yourselves, but nobody ever dared.
Apart from the problems we've already discussed, was life aboard Conway a strain in any other ways?
In a way, yes. I can't say it was like a prison, but you've got to remember that a ship is a very limited place to exercise, to move about in, to get out of the way of other boys. So a certain strain, yes, I suppose, it made you feel cut off from the outside world.
What kind of problems were created by having to live in such close confinement with so many others?
I can't think. I was so young then, really, you see. I can't think that I really felt the problems then. The only one was of survival, I think.
We've talked mostly about the grim side of life aboard Conway, or at least that's the way it's come out. But were there any highlights, things you actually enjoyed?
Oh, yes. You see, we were in charge of the steam pinnace. Well, then there was rowing of all sorts of boats. There were the boats like they had at Oxford and Cambridge, because every year the Conway rowed 1 year on the Thames against the Worcester, and then the Worcester had come to the Conway and row. And besides that, there were the gigs and the cutters and the whalers. And you went out always with somebody who was absolutely proficient, could be one of the senior boys. And you learned to row and that sort of thing. And occasionally you had a pin and a piece of string and a bit of dough, and you shoved it over the side hoping to catch a fish, which you never did. The Mersey was too dirty, and also the tide was too swift, I suppose, and the liner didn't go underwater, but one didn't realise that. I used to fish for hours at the stern of the ship below the captain's quarters. I never caught a thing, never had a bite.
Do I remember correctly that you told me that at this time the Oxford and Cambridge boat race was held every second year on the Mersey?
Not the Oxford and Cambridge, the Conway and Worcester.
Oh, I see.
The Oxford always rode on the Thames, isn't it?
Well, I suppose the final event in your Conway experiences would have been the examinations.
The final examination was just like a school one, you see. You set it, and then you said goodbye to all your friends, knowing you weren't coming back, and you went home, and the report came home to your parents about 3 weeks later.
Now, you fluffed this exam, I think
I told
me.
I failed ignominiously because I wasn't really keen on going into the Navy to start with, and because every time there was any chance of sailing or rowing or certainly going in the pinnace, I was always volunteer when I probably should have been working. And therefore, they only gave two vacancies for each term, so I wasn't in the first two. In fact, I think I was nearly bottom.
So 20 boys were competing for two places?
Yes, a term. And then those two successful chaps went on to Dartmouth.
What were your parents' reactions to your failure? Were you under a bit of a cloud for a while?
Yes, my governor was very good. You've got to remember, he was just an ordinary medical practitioner who, in those days, didn't get a lot of money. I think he got 5 bob if a person came to see him and 7 bob if he went to see them. Well, I was the eldest son, and then I had a sister, 18 months younger, and then I had 2 brothers. You see? Well, he was disappointed, and I think he realised that... He might have realised I was damned ignorant, I don't know, and wouldn't learn, but I think he thought I was lazy, and he was probably right. He was probably right.
Now, after Conway, you went to Plymouth College.
Yes.
This was 1911-1913.
That's right.
And from this time, your interests in a military career come to the fore a bit.
Yes, they came because there was no TC there, and you had a rifle. You were given a uniform, which you kept home. Your rifle was kept in the armoury. And we used to drill, I think it was 2 nights a week after we finished our work at 4:45 for an hour. And... I soon became a lance corporal, and then I was made a corporal and finished up as a sergeant. And we used to go to camp every year in the summer with all the other public schools. You might be lying in your tents next to Charterhouse or Eton or Harrow. And the regular army did the cooking for you. And otherwise you were looked after by your own officer. And you had to see that your tent was properly clean and your bedding put out as the regulation, starting with a ground sheet and then your blankets folded in a certain manner and all your items put out. And as I say, you might be next to Eton or you might be next to anybody, you didn't know. And you used to have field days. Well, I enjoyed it thoroughly, but I didn't understand a lot about it because you were never told anything. we might be part of the attacking unit, and we attacked a certain, we marched for miles, and we had blank ammunition, which we longed to fire off, and suddenly a bugle would blow, and the officer in charge of us would say, "Come on, fall in." We'd fall in from extended order and march back to where we were, and someone would start talking what a wonderful exercise it had been, and the defending force had been overrun, but I didn't see why or how. But it was a good time. You used to meet people from different schools when you went to the equivalent of the NAFI today, you see, in the evening. You might be the schools you played rugby against or cricket, you see, and you'd meet them, which you didn't see any other time. So, really, one had a very good time, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Within Plymouth College, did the OTC figure importantly in the life of the college?
Well, you weren't forced to join in those days, but you were thought of a lot more of if you did, because I think we were about 100 strong, which wasn't, when you think of the probably 400 or 500 boys in the school, wasn't good. But it was better, I suppose, in a way it was better, because they were boys more or less of your own age, and therefore they could do things. You could go on a march, and you know you hadn't to look after two little toddlers or anything. And even then, you didn't want to fall out, because there were different houses in a school. In ours, there was the schoolhouse, north house, and south. North town, south town, and schoolhouse. Well, you didn't want to fall out, because you were letting your house down. Mm-hmm. You see? And therefore, you did everything you could. And you naturally, you played rugby, and you played cricket, and everything. And had a real good time.
What kind of boys joined the OTC? Was it only those interested in army careers?
No, I think a lot of them joined because they got a more or less a free holiday. Well, when I say free, your father had to pay for you for the train journey, wherever it was, from Plymouth to Farnborough or Salisbury Plain, which it was mostly held every year. But it was the excitement of getting away and sleeping rough or out in the open, which one had never done before, you see.
Was the OTC treated seriously by the boys who were members of it?
Oh, yes.
It wasn't a question of just playing at soldiers?
No. It was treated seriously, and you learnt how to dress and become proud of your uniform. And I used to love to put it on.
If the OTC was thought to be important by the boys who were members of it, why was it important?
Well, I think everybody was patriotic in those days. You've got to remember that the Boer War was long past, and people. But I think they still loved uniform, and they loved the idea of going to camp. That was the main point. It was going to camp, and you trained to get a certificate A. Well, regular officers used to come at stated times as asked for by the man who ran the OTC, who was a territorial, you see, and you would be put through your course to get a certificate. You had to drill the men. You had to march them different ways. You had to do all the extended orders, which we did by whistle and arm signals in those days. And then he'd ask you a few questions on the map, quite simple ones. And you either passed or failed. Mm-hmm. That was it.
Let's go on a bit now to the spring of 1914, when you actually joined the 1st Devons, were commissioned into it as a second lieutenant. For this preliminary period before the war, I'm interested in trying to find out something about what life was like in the pre-war regular army. I'd like to start off by talking about one thing which struck me when we spoke last, namely the high cost of being in the army. Could you actually live on your pay when you joined?
No. No, my pay was 5 and 3 pence a day, which was 38 and 9 pence per week. And my messing was 4 shillings a day. Now, on top of that, I had to pay monthly subscriptions, which were to the band fund, to the drums fund, to the silver fund. I also had to pay my servant, which was paid out of my mess bill. And if I played cards, we played for money. No money was allowed to be passed. And it was put down in a book.